69,320. That's the number of students currently enrolled at the University of Central Florida. It's also more than the total number of news analysts, reporters, and journalists in the entire United States. It's more than the number of chiropractors, and nearly 50% more than the number of optometrists. Each year, UCF awards no fewer than 18,000 degrees over the course of a two-day, 26-hour graduation ceremony. It offers 240 unique programs, is spread out across 276 buildings, and employs over 13,000 people. But it wasn't always this big. In fact, this is all quite recent. In the year 2000, it awarded a mere 7,000 degrees. Then, in just 10 short years, enrollment swelled by almost 70%. And it wasn't alone. In the decade leading up to the Great Recession, attendance across the nation soared to unprecedented highs. Arizona State in Phoenix now has 79,000 students, with another 66,000 online. Rutgers in New Jersey, 67,000. This growth came at a cost. More students, for instance, typically means larger classes. Much larger classes. At UCF, as many as 1,200 people. Like many large public schools, its student-to-faculty ratio is extraordinarily high, 30 to 1. And the effects soon spilled over into the labor market. The basic problem looks like this. At least 37% of U.S. workers hold a four-year degree. Yet, only about 32% of jobs require one. The predictable result is that new college grads can't find the work they studied for. A year after graduating, 52 out of 100 are underemployed, and nearly all will remain that way. Over the next 9 years, just 7 of those 52 will find jobs that make use of their education. Inundated with applications, many entry-level positions now call for years of experience, pushing these educated Americans into low-paid service work. More college grads today are employed as cashiers than mechanical engineers. Meanwhile, most jobs, about 52%, are what we would call middle skill, meaning they require some specialized skills or training, but not a bachelor's. These are your electricians, plumbers, carpenters, and construction workers, and we don't have nearly enough of them. Even six-figure, often unionized jobs like crane operator, detective, delivery driver, and court reporter remain unfilled. In any normal market, this problem would quickly resolve itself. As word got out, the supply of college students would fall and the supply of electricians would rise until both matched demand. But that hasn't happened. Sure, college enrollment fell during the pandemic, but these young adults aren't dropping out to become radiologic technicians, carpenters, or plumbers. In the words of a Harvard economist, the market is, quote, consistently failing to clear. In other words, the labor market is broken. Now, the parents and grandparents of these dropouts have a theory, and you can probably guess what it is. Kids these days are just too lazy. They're entitled. They refuse to do the hard work of a mechanic or machinist. But the data tells a different story. Sponsored by Nebula, the exclusive home to my original series, China Actually. Americans haven't always been so obsessed with college. In the 1960s, one in every four members of Congress had only a high school education. The public at the time was far more preoccupied with Vietnam, the energy crisis, and especially the Cold War. So, when the new and largely ignored Department of Education released its report on American schools in 1983, it cleverly embraced the militaristic language of the era. It titled the report, A Nation at Risk, and wrote, quote, "If an unfriendly foreign power attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might have viewed it as an act of war. To defeat the Soviets, we needed to increase our human capital, and we needed to do it yesterday. Suddenly, it had America's attention. Far more than this little-known department ever imagined. 6 million copies would be printed over the next year alone. Education, like an increasing number of things in America, was now an issue of national security, which meant it was now bipartisan, sacred, beyond contention. A nation at risk would open the door to a series of reforms that are still ongoing today, from Common Core to No Child Left Behind. And as time went on, the definition of human capital slowly narrowed from education, very broadly, to college, very specifically. The days of technical skills and career readiness were over. In were academics, general education, standardization, and testing. It all made perfect sense viewed from the highest levels of government. Study after study proved the immense benefits of higher education, from career to health, family, and fulfillment. Clearly, college paid for itself. It was the closest thing we had to a free lunch. Thus, surely, the more, the better. We Americans have never excelled at moderation. And just like that, College for All was born. College was no longer one path, it was the path. It wasn't a solution, it was the solution. In the race to increase enrollment, all else was forgotten. For the next 3 decades, the American public was bombarded with these 3 words, from George Bush to Barack Obama alike. Left, right, or center, it didn't matter. Parents across the spectrum swallowed this message whole. By 2012, 96% of Democrats and 99% of Republicans expected their kids to attend college. And it's not hard to see why. Parents, increasingly anxious about their children's future in an era of unprecedented technological change, globalization, and outsourcing, were sold a solution. There was still a place for their sons and daughters in the middle class. All they had to do, they were reassured, was save up and send them to college. "Study hard," parents told their kids, "or you'll end up mopping the floors." School counselors, with only the best intentions, universally guided high school students toward 4-year degrees. And many kids themselves never once considered not going to college. That is, until after they attended college, at which point 65% have regrets. College for All was so potent an ideology that even parents making great money doing blue-collar work told their kids not to follow in their footsteps. After all, being a good parent meant sending your kids to college. Take elevator installers, for instance. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the median elevator installer in 2022 earned $99,000 a year. Meaning, half make more than 6 figures, doing a job that requires only a high school education. Now, you and I would never know this job existed, never mind that it's more lucrative than being an architect or accountant. Elevator installers become elevator installers because they know an elevator installer. Children of elevator installer parents are over 1,000 times more likely to take up the same line of work. And many of these jobs are quite fulfilling. 87% of skilled tradespeople say they would choose the same career again. Yet, even these well-paid, satisfied professionals took College for All to heart, sending their own kids, the only kids who knew about these jobs, to college instead. The result, of course, is that now, 30 years later, we don't have anyone left to install elevators. 27% of skilled tradespeople are within 10 years of retirement. And when they do retire, their expertise, their book of business, and their trusted names will simply disappear, with no one to take over the family business. Today, more 36 to 40-year-olds join the trades than do 16 to 20-year-olds. Part of what made this campaign so effective was that it quietly took on a class, status, and soon even a moral dimension. Increasingly, college was no longer a means to a job, it was an end in itself, a consumption, some might say, luxury good. As it seeped into mainstream culture, it became a critical, formative phase of any good middle-class life. College is where you make lifelong friends, it's where you meet your future spouse, and it's where adolescents learn to become independent adults. This has always been true for the upper class. But as the much larger middle class poured into college, something interesting happened. Money and status, once inextricably connected, began to diverge. It started out as college equals good jobs. Good jobs, of course, are well paid. And money, naturally, meant status and prestige. It didn't take long before this equation was shortened in the American mind to college equals status. But as more and more Americans were welcomed into this previously elite realm, the oversupply of graduates reduced the financial rewards of a degree. Yet the association between college and status stuck. The strange outcome is that today, many high-status jobs like journalists are so poorly paid that only the rich can afford to take them. Now, word of these declining fortunes certainly got out. The PhD working at Starbucks cliché has been making the rounds since at least the 2008 recession. But even as the younger sibling watched the older one struggle to find work after college and move back in with their parents, he or she still had to attend anyway. It wasn't so much that college would catapult them into the upper classes. Those days were long gone. It was that not attending college would, in their mind, permanently brand them as a failure, relegating them to the lower classes. This may sound to older listeners like silly, frivolous, childish drama. Indeed, it is. But it's silly, frivolous, childish drama that was made very real by the stigmas implicit in College for All. Trade school, it taught Americans, was for the trouble kids, the kids with nowhere else to go. For the past 30 years, in other words, young adults have been trapped. College is no longer the path to riches it once was. Yet not going to college has been ostracized as less than. A bachelor's degree was transformed from a golden ticket to mere table stakes, a requirement simply to preserve their middle-class standing. And sure, we might wish that these students would break free from the stigma, forging their own path. But that's a pretty elaborate obstacle course for a 16, 17, or 18-year-old to navigate. The decision of where, when, and whether to attend college is already plagued by emotion and bias and hormones and marketing. College for All merely amplified these latent pressures by 1,000%. So, needless to say, they went to college. Boy, did they go to college. And when they couldn't find a job after graduating, they faced a new dilemma: what to do next. In theory, nothing stops these overeducated, underemployed 25-year-olds from pursuing skilled blue-collar work. Education requirements, after all, are minimums, not maximums. Financially, this would make a whole lot of sense. Making $81,000 a year as a signal and track switch repairer, for example, sure seems like a great consolation prize given that it pays far more than most white-collar jobs. But again, this is not a purely financial decision. Taking up skilled blue-collar work would mean accepting that the 4 to 6 years they spent laboring away at college were wasted. Let's not forget how hard these graduates fought to get into and through college. From the ACT to the SAT, AP classes, extracurriculars, recommendations, tutoring, and volunteering, the experience of growing up in America has been reshaped by College for All. For some, childhood was sacrificed entirely. And having been taught that the kids who go to college are fundamentally different from the kids who don't, they would have to reconcile the image of themselves built up over a lifetime as a good middle-class achiever. Paradoxically, it's far easier for these young adults to accept low-paid, low-skill work. This, at least, has the advantage of appearing temporary. Service and gig work have been normalized as a stopgap while searching for better-paid employment. And as the number of 25 to 34-year-olds living with their parents has doubled over the past 2 decades, its stigma has faded. Whereas becoming an electrician, plumber, or elevator installer is a long-term proposition. It might involve getting a certificate, apprenticeship, or taking a course. Now, some might argue that although these are all very unfortunate side effects, college for all is still, at its core, a good thing. As mentioned earlier, college serves a valuable social function. There are countless benefits to attending, from friendships to personal growth, community, and sports, that have nothing to do with finding a job. Some would say college is important precisely because it's divorced from the labor market. It's, at least theoretically, the last sanctuary from market forces, where research and learning are encouraged for their own sake. These are all perfectly valid and noble ideals. And indeed, there's no doubt that college for all lowered barriers, making all those benefits more accessible. Over the past three decades, the gates of university were opened, allowing millions upon millions of middle-class Americans into a world once restricted to only the elite. While the Ivy League monopolizes headlines, the vast majority of students attend less selective schools like the University of Central Florida, Rutgers, and Arizona State. Unlike the Harvards of the world, which preserve their exclusivity by tightly restricting their size, these schools aim to grow their market share. UCF, for instance, guarantees admission to graduates of in-state community colleges, giving thousands of Floridians a clear path to higher education. That's the shiny promotional brochure facade of College for All. And it's not exactly wrong. But there's an ugly side to this mass market popularization of college. One that's deliberately hidden from public view. Over the years, whenever Americans have grown even the slightest bit skeptical of college, these schools have fought back with the same weapon. This graph. These are the median annual earnings by age for a high school graduate. This, meanwhile, is a college graduate. And the difference is called the college wage premium. Add all these years up and a college graduate can expect to earn $900,000 more throughout their career. That's still true today. Looking at this graph, most people would conclude that college is a foolproof investment. Clearly, the more you learn, the more you earn. Even if you only made half this amount, you'd still end up with a respectable $450,000 additional dollars. Not bad. But there are two problems with this graph. First, college isn't free. In fact, as you may have heard, it's quite expensive. The average graduate takes out $37,000 in loans, and many, much, much more. Obviously, these student loans, plus interest, will take a big bite out of that college graduate salary. The second problem is far bigger. It has to do with that word, graduate. About half of college students don't. Just 41% earn their bachelor's degree in 4 years. Only 59% do in 6 years. And note that these are only full-time, first-time, traditionally aged students at four-year universities. If your family is poor, if you're not white, and/or if you're a part-time student, your odds of ever graduating plummet. That's a problem, because financially, college really only becomes valuable the day you graduate. Some college, even 3.999 years, is barely worth anything. These are the wages of college grads, these of high school grads, and these of some college but no bachelors. Although the actual number is even lower, since this also includes those with an associate's degree. In other words, the value of college really depends on who you are. The college wage premium is an average, and no one person is exactly average. Or, to be more precise, students from 1,700 U.S. colleges earn an average of at least $10,000 a year more than a high school graduate. For these students, college is a fantastic investment. The college wage premium vastly undersells the value of their degree. Next, about a third as many earn a solid but not high salary, between $37,000 and $42,000 a year. Then, for the same number, college is more or less a wash. They make nearly the same amount as a high school graduate. And finally, almost twice as many make less than the average high school graduate. These, consisting mainly of those who never graduated, are the real collateral damage of College for All. They don't earn any higher wages. In fact, they earn less. Yet they do have thousands and thousands of dollars worth of debt. The worst of both worlds. For this sizable group, college was the most expensive detour they'll ever take. These are the victims of the trap set by College for All. Because these graduates over here are earning so much money, they raise the college premium average, creating false hope for the less fortunate. Sure, for a few of these lucky winners, college really was a route to upward social mobility, from rags to riches. They converted computer science degrees into transformative generational wealth. But for many others, College for All just made poor kids even poorer. In the words, oddly enough, of Harvard professor Michael Sandel, quote, "In practice, most colleges and universities do less to expand opportunity than to consolidate privilege." To illustrate this, the economist Douglas Weber created this graph. It shows that once you account for the chance of dropping out, plus $50,000 in tuition each year, the odds of college paying off are about the same as flipping a coin. Now, that may be a fair price to pay for middle and upper class families who can comfortably absorb this risk. But for the less well off, this turns college into a fairly dangerous gamble. And yet, it's precisely these same less well-off kids who are more likely to drop out and end up under or unemployed, meaning their odds are even lower. In principle, dropping out need not be such a bad thing. Like college graduates who can't find white-collar employment, they could simply work in the trades. There, in fact, they might earn more than their friends with degrees, and in less time. But for several reasons, they likely won't. First, as their student loans start coming due, they need money today, not tomorrow. They don't have the luxury of taking time to learn a new skill. Second, having been told that college was a guaranteed path to riches only to find out that it wasn't, how likely are they to see more education, getting a certificate or taking a training course, as the solution? For understandable reasons, they probably feel disaffected and disengaged, not ready to enroll at their local community college. Meanwhile, College for All has led to degree inflation, meaning many of the jobs once available to them now require a bachelor's. All of these things will push him or her into low-skill work, contributing to the shortage of middle-skill labor. And these shortages will keep getting worse. Together, the bipartisan Infrastructure Law, CHIPS and Science Act, and Inflation Reduction Act are expected to create 3 million jobs a year. And the vast majority are classified as middle skill. Now more than ever, America needs electricians, welders, mechanics, pipe layers, and machinists. Yet, at the same time, a record number of workers are leaving the labor market completely. During the pandemic alone, nearly 3 million Americans retired early, turning the long-term chronic shortages created by College for All into an acute crisis. So, what can we do? The temptation, of course, is to simply tell kids to stop going to college and go to a trade, technical, or vocational school instead. But this solution misunderstands the problem. For 30 years, Americans have been fed one narrow definition of success. Teenagers were not told to do the math, weigh their options, or consider their circumstances. No, they were told universally, go to college. This was an understandable overcorrection from the days when kids were almost as universally told not to. Not so long ago, only the wealthy were groomed for college, while the less privileged were quietly steered into underfunded vocational programs. The challenge today is to correct our mistakes without overcorrecting again. College is not the problem. College for All is the problem. Likewise, trade school is a solution, but trade school for all isn't the solution. One-size-fits-all solutions are how we ended up here in the first place. By encouraging everyone to become a plumber, we'd only create the opposite problem – too many plumbers. One reason College for All has gone unchallenged for so long is that it's very, very profitable. But the other reason is well-intentioned. out of concern that by being honest about the value of college, we might dissuade students from attending who would truly benefit. This is understandable, and it's why we should be careful now not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't want to return to the pre-college for all days when poor and disadvantaged kids were tracked into neglected second-rate schools. The goal is not to remove the opportunity to attend college, it's to remove the obligation. Currently, the stigma against skilled blue-collar work is so strong that young lower, middle, and even upper-class kids alike avoid well-paid, fulfilling careers. Careers they might actually enjoy more than white-collar work. The stigma is so strong, in fact, that parents and grandparents consider their children's behavior irrational, assuming they must be lazy. What we need is a radical shift in the way we value different kinds of work. An acceptance that we need different people to do different jobs, and that each is valuable. Only then will Americans be free to choose a career that suits their tastes and talents. Although, truth be told, this is not just an American issue. Take nearly everything in this video, multiply it by 100 times, and you have a glimpse, for example, at the problem China is now faced with. Chinese students fight even harder to get into college. Chinese vocational schools are even more underfunded. And the stigma against blue-collar work is even stronger. The bill for College for All is now coming due in China, too, as millions of young graduates remain under or unemployed. And the effects will be even more widely felt, especially since most families now rely on just one child for support. This is yet another unintended consequence of the one-child policy, whose rise and fall I explain in much greater detail in this episode of my Nebula original series, China Actually. I also have episodes on China's dominance of rare earth metals, its claim to have alleviated poverty, and how Chinese censorship works in practice. Nebula is the streaming service built by and for independent creators. It's the place where we can push the boundaries of online video, pursue our passion projects free from the whims of the YouTube algorithm, and build a viewing experience optimized for your enjoyment, not advertising. We've just, for example, released our biggest update to Nebula ever, featuring a beautiful new UI and, based on popular feedback, a dedicated Nebula news page, hand-curated by the team behind TLDR News. Just in the next few months alone, we have brand new exclusive originals planned like Real-Life Lore's The War Room, Tom Nicholas's documentary Boomers, The Dinner Plan, a short film by the amazing Patrick Willems, and too many others to mention here. If you're not subscribed to Nebula, you're missing out on some of the most interesting videos on the internet, and frankly, one of the most interesting stories in the creator economy. We're building a platform free from ads, a place where viewer and creator incentives are aligned to make the best possible videos, rather than chasing short-term views. Take Abigail Thorne's upcoming movie, Dracula's Ex-Girlfriend. On YouTube, such a high-budget, high-production project would simply be more risk than it's worth. But because Nebula is supported by viewers like you, we could spend thousands of dollars upfront to make this dream a reality. Now, normally, Nebula costs $5 a month, but you can get it for just half that by signing up for a year with a link on screen or in the description now. That's just $2.50 a month to start watching my exclusive series and much more.